Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. We hope you enjoy the show.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Cactus Cafe. While you're getting settled, woo! So great to see everyone tonight. Such a beautiful night, and you could be anywhere, but you're here, and we're so grateful. And there's one more person who made especially tonight happen, and he is from the Elizabeth Ney Museum, so we're celebrating their existence here in Austin. The executive director, Oliver Franklin, he's going to come up and tell us about the museum.
Man, I'd like to have somebody who makes all things possible. Can we have some of them? Yeah, that's awesome. So thanks for coming tonight. I'm Oliver Franklin. Thank you guys so very much. I'm the director of the Elizabeth Ney Museum. How many people here, like our table neighbors, have not been to the Elizabeth Ney Museum ever? All right, well, we want to change that. We are up there in Hyde Park, where castle and stone castle and 2.5 acres that belonged to Elizabeth Ney, who was a really remarkable individual in Austin, well, in really Germany, and then the United States, and then Austin. One of the things that's very exciting about Elizabeth is one of her favorite things to do is to congregate people and talk about things. Having salons on the banks of the Waller Creek there was one of her big things. So we've been really trying to engage people and talk about interesting things. And this is exciting because this is the first time I think that Elizabeth Ney had ever worked off-site before. And I'm a big fan of these two guys. And these two guys, Elizabeth's husband's name was Edmund Montgomery, and he was a philosopher, actually published in multiple languages even after they moved to Austin. He wrote a paper called Are We Conscious Automata? He wrote that in 1895, and that was just such a cool line. We had to do something with it. So a couple years ago, we did something with Dionysium, which was a whole lot of fun. It was a speed. It was a Are We Conscious Automata speed philosophy event. So we're always trying to find new and interesting ways to address Are We Conscious Automata? And tonight, we're really excited to be able to address the question, Are Two Guys Conscious Automata? Right? So I'm not going to say any more. I do want to encourage you guys to come to the museum. We have a whole lot of exciting events. We've got these great cards up at the table we're at back there, and they have all our social media on it, and you don't need to know anything more. You just go to those places, and you'll find it all out. So, listen, thank you very much. I'm very excited. You guys are great. Sursum, right? That's what she said. I mean, that's what Elizabeth said. All right.
Thank you so much, Oliver. So if you don't know them already, tonight to talk about this question of are we conscious automata, or just do we have free will, or is everything predetermined for us?
I knew you were going to say that.
Okay, two guys on your head, Dr. Art Markman and Dr. Bob Duke. Welcome. So let's hear a little bit from this fantastic paper just to get a sense of what we're talking about tonight.
For the two or three of you who haven't read it.
From this fantastic paper.
Rebecca has selected this excerpt and asked me to read it, but I should probably answer the question that was posed a minute ago. Is are Art and I conscious automata? And the answer is we are not. We are not conscious. So here's an excerpt. Now you have to remember this was written in the late 1890s. So the phraseology and everything, which is just lovely. I love language at that time, but here we go. For without a modicum of it, meaning consciousness, the plant sinks its eager roots into the fruitful soil, lifts its slender stem into the luminous air. I tell you, this guy's adjective closet is amazing. Spreads wide and wider its verdant foliage, in the chemic influx that elaborates life's all-nourishing pabulum, and finally bursts into the gorgeous, sweet-scented splendor of the insect-luring bloom, solemnizing thus, arrayed in delicate beauty, the hymeneal, yes, it means what you think it means, rites of creation. And all of this rich fulfillment of far-reaching purpose without a trace of conscious participation. Now, is it not likely that man, sharing with his humbler brethren the vicissitudes of existence, with all its fateful round of doings from the hour of birth to that of death, is not likely that his consciousness, not less than theirs, however intently concerned in the shifting scenes of life, is witnessing them also as a mere unparticipating spectator?
Well, my. So that is the role of the public intellectual and the philosopher in the 1800s. And so one thing we're going to get to is who has time to think about these things anymore and write about them like this. But what I want to talk about is, like, where was this question? Why was this such a big question in philosophy, free will versus determinism?
Well, this was such a cool time in intellectually in the world, right? So the theory of evolution was fairly new. There were species being discovered all over the place. The field of psychology was just barely trying to wrest itself free of philosophy. I mean, it was an amazing, absolutely amazing time. And it was probably the last time intellectually where science, philosophy, spiritualism, and religion all kind of freely intermingled. These things began to separate themselves out a lot more in the early 20th century. And so it was a really fascinating time. And there were so many discoveries being made biologically. And because of the theory of evolution, see, this is the really interesting part. Prior to the theory of evolution, anything you learned about another animal didn't necessarily matter that much for humans because we weren't the same thing. But once you've got a theory of evolution that says we're on a continuum of animals, then everything we learn about animals begins to say something about humans. And on top of that, we're getting more and more complicated machines. And so now we're beginning to get, for example, these hydraulic machines that do all this amazing stuff. And it begins to make you wonder, is there anything in there with humans? And I just want to tell one little story about this that I think illustrates where some of this angst comes from. So there's a wasp that the philosopher Daniel Dennett talks a lot about in some of his work on free will, and it's called the Sphex wasp. And the wasp has this very elaborate routine. It will sting prey until they're paralyzed. Then it drags the prey to the nest. Then it looks into the nest to make sure there's no predators. And if the nest is clear, then it takes the prey and it drags it into the nest and it eats it. So you think, wow, that's pretty awesome. It must have this idea that, you know, it's got to look to be safe for predators. Well, you know, biologists who want to mess with a Sphex wasp, when the Sphex is in there looking in the nest to make sure there's no predators, they'll take the prey and move it a couple of inches away. And now the Sphex comes back out, sees the prey, walks over, grabs it, pulls it back to the nest, goes and looks in the nest to make sure there's no predators, comes back out. Now, if the enterprising biologist pulls the prey away, it creates an endless loop in which this thing, because it's not thinking about what to do. It's just programmed in this very elaborate sequence of behaviors. It is an automaton, basically. And once you realize that the wasp goes through this really elaborate set of behaviors because it's programmed to, it's only a short step from there to wonder whether all the rest of us are just doing the same thing. But because we have the glory of consciousness to go with it, we're blissfully unaware of how much of a machine we are.
Yeah, and you know, probably something that we could say in relationship to the article that I just read an excerpt from is it was ever thus, right? I mean, the idea of free will in human beings has been a question since Plato, right? And the question of how much control do we actually have over our behavior and over the decisions that we make has been an ongoing question that, you know, in some ways doesn't have an answer, but actually in other ways is answerable. You might when you listen to the show, you probably have heard many times at the beginning of the show in the little montage they have at the beginning. I just had to work the word montage into that. There's a thing that I say that our minds are our brains. I mean, the common conception among most human beings is that we have a mind that lives inside our brain, and our brain lives inside our skull, and our bodies carry that around. And it sort of feels like this sort of segmented thing. But what I mean when I said in that clip that our minds are our brains is that the things that emerge as what we think of as mind in human beings, that is our consciousness, what we think of as awareness, those kinds of things, are experiences that are actually created by physical stuff. And we tend not to think about things that way because what we experience as our own consciousness seems quite apart from any physical stuff. And it's understandable we would think that, right? Because it's hard to imagine that this leads to that, leads to that, leads to that. But what we don't really think about often is the fact that our brain comprises 86 billion, that's billion with a B, neurons that make upwards of 100 trillion connections with each other. That's a lot of circuitry, right? And one of the things that's remarkable about complexity, and people who study complexity, is that out of very simple structures, pretty complicated things can emerge. And one of the things that I think, you know, Art alluded to in what he said a moment ago and what was a little bit mentioned in the article, not the segment I read, is that we can certainly think about things. I mean, you know, somebody said a long time ago, every wise person said, I think, therefore I am. So that's something that we have little evidence that other primates could actually consider that proposition, right? So we can consider that proposition. But because we can, we then extend that to make inferences about how much control we have over what we do.
And we should point out that there's a whole lot of stuff that we don't have much control over, right? So we should point out that even if, you know, I think the question of is there free will is undecided. So we're, you know, just to give away the ending. But it's decided. Montgomery was decided. He wanted there to be free will, so there was. I mean, that's more or less.
Well, he willed it. So.
He willed it. Yeah. But I, you know, I think the question itself is undecided, but we certainly recognize that there are a lot of things for which it seems pretty decided. Like, you know, as anyone who knows me well, if there's open ice cream in my vicinity and a spoon, I will eat it. Even without the spoon.
I will attest to that, yes. That.
Yeah. And there's no free will really associated with that whatsoever. So obviously, look, you know, I mean, if your visual system works normally and you open your eyes and you get this incredible experience of the visual world around you, you're not trying to do that. That is simply something that happens as a result of opening your eyes. And in fact, your eyes are constantly moving around the visual scene. You're not even aware of that, let alone controlling it, right? So there's a tremendous amount about what we're doing that is clearly not under any semblance of control. So we're really talking about, you know, the margins here. Is, you know, at the very edges of behavior, is there something that isn't just being governed by the various physical interactions that we're having with the environment?
And when we get back to these questions of the history of philosophy, it's also important to remember that consciousness was not allotted to everyone. So women weren't considered people when these questions were being asked. Just FYI. And so, you know, a lot of these questions are about who we are as humans, but also right. who we attribute human consciousness to
right.
as well.
Right.
And one thing that you didn't mention with this body-mind dichotomy was the presence of the soul.
Yes.
And so when that comes in and where that's going to spend eternity, the question of free will really does come into play with religion.
Well, I think if anybody has faith in the idea that there is a soul that is not actually part of the body, that will continue to exist after the body no longer does, it's impossible now. I mean, to hold that belief and also believe that there are many mechanical things that are going on in bodies. I mean, I mean that's certainly understandable. The thing I want to say though about just picking up on what Art was saying was the many decisions that we have opportunities to make in a given waking day, right? I mean, you think about all the things that we do. I mean, I just made my hand go like that. I didn't volitionally say, hey, it's time to make your left hand do that thing. You know, I didn't do that. It just did that. And there are lots of things that we do throughout every day that require no volitional decision making on our part. Now, if you think about most of our behavior that way, it certainly introduces the idea that if there are things that we seemingly decide that we don't actually decide, is it possible that everything we decide we don't actually decide, right? Now, the thing that's interesting about this, and I was thinking about this all day today about, you know, how to frame this discussion and how to kind of make sense of all of this, or at least, you know, find a way to think about it. And, you know, just like when Art was talking about the Spex wasp, if you were to watch that behavior, or you watch a bowerbird build a nest, and you think, man, that thing knows what it's doing, you know, because there's no way it would be behaving that way. And we impute motives to all kinds of organisms that really are just behaving on some program that's spinning out, right? But one of the things to think about is one of the privileges that consciousness gives to us is the capacity to observe our behavior, right? And it would be understandable, just as we would attribute motivations to organisms that have no motivations, they're just operating on automatic pilot, to do that for ourselves, right? We're able to witness ourselves doing things and thinking, well, goodness, that must be because this and then that, and then I decided this and then this happened. And this is such an interesting aspect of thinking about being a human being, because there have been arguments as long as there have been people to have them about, well, what does that mean for the dignity of human beings? And many of you who are, you know, philosophers, psychology, bridging fans know that B.F. Skinner in the middle of the 20th century wrote a book called Beyond Freedom and Dignity, which brought up the idea of, well, wait a minute, it doesn't mean that we reduce the dignity of human beings because we operate in a world that influences our behavior, right? And that argument has been going on for a very long time. Like I said, this goes back to Plato, and probably before Plato, when people just grunted ideas. So I think one of the things interesting to think about in this is how to think about this in a productive way without expecting there's going to be a final answer when you get to the end of the evening.
Yeah, and on top of that, to return to Rebecca's question, I mean, the religion and the law both presume a certain degree of free will, right? I mean, you know, if we expect that someone volitionally committed a crime and therefore should be punished, and in fact, you know, we make a distinction between crimes that are committed where you meant to do it and didn't mean to do it. It's the difference between murder and manslaughter, for example, right? Which has to do with intent, which presumably has to do with free will. And of course, religions, particularly those religions that want to consign evildoers to hell or Cleveland or something, they
is there a difference?
I don't know. And But those religions are also presuming that people are making a choice of some kind about the behaviors to carry out. And it's a little disconcerting to contemplate the idea that in fact all you're doing is reacting as a machine to things that are in the environment, and that therefore you are not responsible in some cosmic sense for for your actions. The fascinating piece, though, about this is that, as Bob was saying, the environment does have a tremendous influence on behavior. So even if we are automata, creating rule systems, and even rule systems that could potentially consign you to hell, becomes part of that environment that then influences the behavior. So we'd still need to have all that stuff in place, potentially, to govern behavior, maybe not hell, but rule systems in which we operate, because that still does have an influence on our behavior, even if the brain gets there before our consciousness does, which is in some sense a big part of the question here.
Yeah, and you know, if we think about what empirical evidence speaks to these questions, I mean, probably the most, I don't know, apt example to think about this is that when we can look at individual neuronal firing in response to certain stimuli, and we can do that with animals in a way that we can't do it ethically with human beings, probably the most interesting series of studies were with, I don't remember the species of monkey, but a monkey that was in an apparatus where many of the monkey's neurons were being able to, were able to monitor with microelectrodes. And what was demonstrated is when food was placed within reach of the monkey, that the monkey's motor signals to begin reaching for the food, that part of the brain that activates those motor signals, would activate almost a half second before the parts of the brain that were thought to be representative of recognition of the fact that there's food there. Now that's weird, because you got to think, well, how come, you know, if you think, well, there's food and I'm going to reach for it and get it, the sequence of events that we imagine is, well, there's a cause, and the cause is somebody put food in reach, and then that cause has an effect, and that is the organism had made a decision to go reach for the food. But the problem is, when you look at that in terms of the sequence of firing of nerve cells in the brain, the sequence doesn't match that supposition, right? And we don't like that, because what we'd like to think is, well, we take in the environment, we process the information that comes in from our various senses, and then we make decisions about acting on those things. And as I said a few minutes ago, if we actually had to consciously decide on every action we took, we would be exhausted, right? Now, many of us are exhausted anyway, but I mean, to make every decision about what my fingers have to do as I reach down to pick up a glass and whether to pick up the glass, and whether I should activate my tongue now to begin the swallowing motion. I mean, if I had to decide all that stuff, it would be impossible for me to function at all.
And just to pick up on this a little bit more, so another piece of this, at the very end of what I was saying before, I mentioned the word consciousness in this. And of course, part of this whole belief about free will involves this idea that we have this conscious experience that we tell ourselves, I'm going to do this, and then we do it. And so we make this decision that consciousness, because the conscious experience precedes when we actually do the thing, we figure, well, we must have willed it into existence. So another interesting thing about the philosophy literature, because a lot of philosophers have spent a lot of time thinking about this, is actually to return to Dan Dennett. He has pointed out something really troubling about consciousness, which is that your conscious experience of things gets calculated a little bit after the fact. And here's how you know this is true. And I could describe I'll describe the experiment in a second, but I just want to motivate the example with, you guys know how cartoons work, right? You know, you see like a character walking through the forest, and it's not that they're really walking. What you've got are usually these two still images. So there's the leg raised, and then the leg down on the ground, and they're alternating back and forth between them. But then your brain fills in the motion. Okay, well, here's ultimately the intuition that he's playing with. How can your brain fill in the motion of the leg movement downward until after the second image appears, so that your consciousness knows where the leg is supposed to go? Right? It can't. So what that means is your conscious experience of seeing this thing walking is not happening in the moment. It's lagging behind a little bit so that it can figure out what it is it's supposed to tell you is happening. Okay? So if your conscious experience is lagging behind stuff, it's probably also lagging behind the decisions that get involved to make motions and do all sorts of other things. So this whole conscious experience we have is a story that's being told, and it's a somewhat incomplete story, because if you stop people, you know, if you stop people just when the leg is up in the air, then all they see is a leg up in the air, and that's what they report. So it's, you know, you're constantly sort of updating this conscious experience, but what that means is that that our internal experience of what it's like to be human is not a particularly good piece of evidence for a lot of things, including whether we have free will. And that's, I think, a particularly troubling conclusion to come to, but seems to fit the data.
You know, I just want to tell you about one other set of experiments reported by Daniel Wegman, who's a psychologist at Yale and wrote a very interesting book called the, it's Daniel, right?
Yeah, Wegner.
Wegner, yeah. What did I say? Wegman. Yeah, Daniel Wegner, thank you. I knew something was wrong about that. My consciousness told me that. He wrote this book called the Illusion of Conscious Will. And if you're into this, you want to read some data about it, it's a great book to read that. And the title sort of tells you the bent of the book. But the example that Wegner uses is, you know, if people go and they play with a Ouija board, and, you know, two people are on their hands on the little, there's a name for that thing, but I don't remember what it is. Anyway.
The Ouija thingy.
The Ouija thing, right. Thank you. Art's full of technical knowledge.
When they're cleaning the board, they call it a squeegee.
That's right. Oh, snap. Okay. So anyway, so your hands are on the thing, and then somebody asks a question, and then the people who are participating in this have the sense that something else is moving this thing, right? And it goes to yes, you know, your sister really is a doofus, you know, yes. Or I don't know where that came from. But anyway, it goes to somebody. And you have the sense that something is moving that's not you, right? Now, Wegner's comparison about all of this is that we have a sense that something is doing stuff with our bodies, except that the something is our free will. But our free will isn't any more real than the thing moving the thing on the Ouija board, right? I mean, we imagine that because it seems like that. It feels like that. And if you think about that, we are beings that evolved over billions of years, right? There are all kinds of things that we can point to say, evolution selected for that aspect of that being, whatever that is, whether it's a color of coat or length of talon or whatever it happens to be. What happened when we got to humans is there's stuff that was selected for that could be co-opted to do stuff that it wasn't really selected for. I mean, we're a bunch of human beings sitting in a room listening to a couple people talk to you over microphones while you're drinking a beverage that sort of chills you out a little bit. This was not evolutionary selected for, right? I mean, evolution did not choose this, right? But evolution selected for certain capacities that then we do this with them, right? Now, the interesting thing about that to me is that now that I have consciousness and I can reflect, and not only can I reflect into the past, I can imagine into the future. Why would I not think that I have a lot of control over what's going on, even when I don't?
And then on top of that, one last, we'll let you talk.
This happens every time. I can never get a word in. Yeah. Oh, well.
So one last thing about this is that we also have, you know, human beings are remarkably complicated. I mean, unlike that Sphex wasp where it's going to keep doing the same thing over and over again, the fact is we don't do a particularly good job of predicting what other people are going to do, or even really ourselves. I mean, we predict a little bit, but we're not so good at it that we can just stop paying attention. And so, you know, on top of everything else, this concept of free will is really valuable as an explanatory construct for what's going on with other people, because we need something to grab onto to help us to figure out why somebody did something that was completely unexpected. So it also plays, I think, a really important role in our understanding of other people, whether it exists or not. Right. And again, the jury is out on this. Right. I mean, there's clearly a lot of stuff we do purely mechanistically. But then there's a lot of stuff that's utterly unpredictable, either because the system is really complicated or because, you know, something else happened. You know, there are people who invoke quantum physics and the collapsing of quantum waveforms, because, you know, all of these probabilities, you know, there's all these events that have some probability of happening, and until the waveform collapses, they're all sort of happening, and then the waveform collapses and only one of them has happened. And so, you know, who knows, right? Something like that kind of mechanism might be involved in some of the decision processes in the brain that actually create something like what free will is about. So the jury is out on this, but what I'm saying is, even in the worst case, I guess it would be the worst case, where we are just conscious automata, it's still really useful to assume that we have free will. From an explanatory standpoint.
But there's another part of this conversation which is really interesting as well, which is like the idea of what an automata was at this time, automaton at this time, was like this little kind of machine that could like poop by itself and move around and open its mouth, you know, and this was a spectacle, you know? Yeah. And everyone was like, if they can create something like that, that means there's no role for me in this world. So the idea of what it
so
means
I should
to be
vote for
this is not a political show.
Don't this, just don't. But, don't.
That idea of, you know, what does artificial life, all of these, you know, what does technology today tell us about this question? How are we informed by the idea that we're going to be taken over by artificial intelligence?
Yeah.
Like, how does that inform how we relate to this idea?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of things to think about here, and I'm going to illustrate this with what to me is one of the most interesting natural experiments that was done about human behavior. I think we talked about this at a different Views and Brews several years ago, but the country of New Zealand collected a huge data set of personal information from a group of, I think it was somewhat over 1,000 children, 1,100 something children, that they recruited by contacting their parents when they were first born, and they monitored these children throughout their lifespan into their late 20s, and they had health data on these children, they had how they performed in school, personality tests, all kinds of things that sort of illustrated what these children were like, including their genes, including their genetic makeup. And in the interesting confluences of science that take information from one place and use it to illuminate something in another place, there was a family in Denmark, I think, that all the males in the family were reprobates. They were just horrible. They were all arrested. They got in fights. They're just terrible. And some geneticist said, well, let's look and see if there are any indicators in their genetic code that have in common that is not common among the population. And in fact, they did isolate a gene, and the work of that gene is to oxidize neurotransmitter. And what that means is, you know, we have little synapses in our brain the way neurons communicate with one another. So one neuron pumps some neurotransmitter into that space, the downstream neuron detects that neurotransmitter, it fires, and that's how signals get passed through the brain. If you have too much neurotransmitter in your brain, what happens often is you become impulsive and you have difficulty inhibiting things that you kind of feel like doing, even though you probably shouldn't, given the long-term consequences. So they identified this in this family, and they looked at this population in New Zealand of these children, right? And the question that was asked, which is a really interesting question, we know, and we've talked about this before on the show and here in Views and Brews, that having abusive experiences when you're a child increases the likelihood that you're going to become a violent adult. We know that. But these scientists asked the question a different way. They said, why do some children who experience abuse as children not become violent adults? Now, that's an interesting question. I mean, the probability doesn't go to one, right? So what is it? So they looked at this gene, right? It happens to be on the Y chromosome because the greatest predictor of violent behavior is a Y chromosome. Own up to it, guys. But what was interesting is, right, so they looked at males in this population, and what they found is if males had the same mutation that this Dutch family had, and they had suffered abuse as a child, they in fact became violent adults. If they did not have that mutation, they did not become violent adults, even though they had suffered abuse. I shouldn't say absolutely, but there was a much lower probability. But here's the kicker, right? If they didn't have the mutation and they suffered abuse as children, they were much less likely to become violent adults than children who had the mutation. Now think about that for a minute, right? You've all heard the phrase, which is used all the time, nature versus nurture. You know, that's the wrong construction. And Matt Ridley, a great science writer, wrote a book whose title I thought was just brilliant. And the title was called Nature Via Nurture, right? So the genetic predispositions that we all come into the world with set the stage for how we respond to the experiences that we have as human beings.
And now I'm gonna take this in a slightly different direction. I love that story.
Yeah.
And I want to just, because I want to think a little bit about our relationship to technology and all this, because that does play a role in
Absolutely.
Our interpretation of things. And if you look, so think about you know, take science fiction as a marker of how we feel about our relationship to technology. And there was certainly angst in the 1890s and the early 20th century about technology, and you got books by people like Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, which tended not to be about machines taking over the world, right? If we were going to be taken over, it was going to be more War of the Worlds type thing, where the Martians were going to come down and destroy us. There was going to be some species more intelligent than we are. So science at that point gave us angst, in part because we were creating weapons that were dangerous, and in part because we were learning that we weren't necessarily alone in the universe, and that was scaring us. And it took another 30 or 40 years before we really got into, and then the machines are going to eat us up, which is the phase we're still more or less in, right? That's where you get the Matrix and other kinds of things where just we're going to be swallowed up by the machines. And so that, I mean, I think that there is a certain amount of angst, right? Where there's going to be some evil, you know, bit of evil in the machines, and then we're not going to be able to control that, and then all heck is going to break loose. And I think we, you know, it this reflects not just, I think, an existential fear about being destroyed by the machines, but I think much more that fear that our relevance in the world is going to be diminished by machines that are increasingly able to do a lot of things that we used to think of as being quintessentially human things. And so, you know, and again, right, that also plays into our beliefs about free will, because at the point where you have a machine that does all sorts of really interesting, really unpredictable things, many of which could be better than what a human could do, right? You know, the machine beats us at chess, and it, you know, and all sorts of other things. Well, at that point, you're thinking, well, what, you know, and that machine's clearly not conscious because we programmed it. So now, you know, what does that say about us? So I think one of the reasons you see that much angst in science fiction, in movies and books, is just because we're still grappling with the fact that the machines are diminishing what it was that made us special as humans.
Yeah. I want to say a happy thing now. About not being swallowed by machines. Or, yeah. And it's this. You know, ourselves... our bodies, the stuff that we do.
It was a book, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly right. It's a lovely book, and I read it many times as a young boy. you had to go there. You know, we take comfort in the fact that we feel like we have some volitional control over what we do. And that's a lovely thing. And it's interesting to me that we have evolved to respond to the environments that we have in ways that are generally predictable. I mean, not entirely predictable, but generally predictable. But one of the things that consciousness provides that other organisms don't provide is we can actually structure our own environment. I mean, pigeons don't choose their friends. Right? Pigeons don't decide what town they're going to live in. Pigeons don't decide whether they're going to go to school. Now, I sound like I'm being flippant about this. I'm really not. You know, I give a talk in one of my human learning and behavior class for undergraduates, and it's got the difference between humans and pigeons. And it's not the difference you think. It's not that we don't respond to environmental cues, and it's not that we don't respond to reinforcement and threats of punishment. We certainly do, right? But the idea is we have the capacity to create our own environment. So to think about Art's compulsive ice cream eating, he can choose not to bring that single serving pint container of ice cream into his home. And not,
but why?
Well, but why? Exactly. I mean, he can make that choice. You know, if I know that a particular person, that every time I'm with them, we complain about everything, and at the end of the conversation, I feel like hell, I can choose not to spend time with that person. Knowing that if I'm in that person's presence, I'm going to get into that stuff, and it's going to be really unhappy. Okay, and I can't control that. But I can control whether I spend time with her or not. I can't control what food is in my house. And that capacity is an interesting way of thinking about free will. Because what Art and I have said on many occasions, when we talked about on many shows, is that we human beings respond to things that are this far in the future, right? What our consciousness and our imagination allows us to do is imagine things far into the future, that we don't put things this close to us that we know will move us in a direction that we don't want to go.
But so maybe our criminal justice system and those of religion should rethink who has access to that control of their environment and who doesn't instead.
Okay.
But
okay,
Wait. Judith Butler would be very happy to know that you read Our Bodies, Ourselves.
It's made me a better man. I'll say I completely wiped everything out.
Well, we do have to go to audience questions, but go ahead. Do you have something?
I'll get to it later.
Let's open things up, because I sometimes get to ask these guys questions, but you rarely do. So please raise your hand.
Hi there. My name is Eric. You guys talked a lot about like external stimuli and how we react to them and how our consciousness deals with the external stimuli. But what about when your imagination goes deeper, like an author creating an entire universe, isn't that like an example of how they are expressing their free will and their creativity? Because it may not, it has some ties in, but not really like a direct reaction to something.
Yeah.
The thing about creativity is that it's also strongly driven by a lot of the stuff that's in our memories, right? I mean, a lot of what we do when we're being creative is combining and recombining ideas and experiences that we've had before. So that internal environment, and the other thing to say is that internal environment that we create uses all of the same hardware that we use to run that we're using when we're getting a visual experience of the world. So that imaginary experience is still using the brain regions that are associated with vision. So, you know, the machinery in there is still doing a tremendous amount of work. So, I mean, creativity is fascinating. And an extraordinarily, it's an amazing part of what humans are able to do. But I'm not sure that we escape anything with respect to the question of free will just by thinking about that combination of ideas, because it's still using a lot of the same mechanisms.
Yeah, I think if you talk to most creative people, whether it's a composer or a novelist or poet or whatever. Well, and I do that a lot. And one of the things that's always interesting to me, when I say, where'd that come from? You know what? They have no idea. You know, I mean, I got stuff in there, and somehow that got attracted to what I'm doing in the moment. And this is the thing about, the cool thing about having many experiences in your memory, right? I mean, Art has talked about this very eloquently about what creativity requires, and it requires a rich and diverse set of memories that you can combine in ways that you even can't anticipate. But again, that happens in a way that I don't think anybody would describe as volitional. I think there are very few people who say, you know, I planned this because I knew these things and therefore I did this thing. I mean, most creative people say, I don't know, I woke up one morning and I thought, oh, I know how to do that plot. And they kind of change something and they don't even know how they did it. And I believe them. They don't know how they did it because what was happening in their brain was not amenable to conscious awareness.
I remembered what I was going to say before.
Thank God!
And it was because it was another happy thing. That's why, which is, you could see why I lost it then.
Not so, to be lost.
So here's regardless of the status of free will, right? We get to enjoy our conscious experiences. They bring us pleasure. So the thing I wanted to remind you all is that after this is over, you're going to walk outside, and it's probably going to be just about sunset. So whether you do it because I'm telling you to or because you choose to do it, take a moment to look at something pretty in the environment and enjoy it, because it's really cool regardless of free will, right? So just, you know, stop and smell the roses, I guess. Is
that, wow.
I just that made that up.
Something.
Yeah. Anyhow, that was my happy thing.
Deep thoughts from two guys on your head. So another question right in the back here.
Good evening. Hey, Art, this might be up your alley. I believe that free will is something that we believe we have, a lot like people who believe in religion believe in God. But I actually think freedom's a powerful concept in both religion and our narrative conception of ourselves. So I kind of argue that we're just believing in the concept, but let's get beyond that. Is there a spectrum of freeness that we can feel? And what is the role of intoxicants and addiction as we have a addiction epidemic right now?
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that's interesting about people who do suffer from addiction, whatever that happens to be, is that there are aspects of life experience that are intolerable, right? I mean, that there's no apparent solution to problems that seem completely intractable and devastating and those kinds of things. And suddenly I can do this thing, whatever it is, you know, smoke a joint or snort a line or have some scotch or whatever and feel better about that. I mean, it's understandable why somebody would get to that point. But, you know, what's interesting about that, since you mentioned addiction, is it gets back to the point about what's in your environment, what resources are in your environment. I mean, many of us, I think, are fortunate enough to have people in our environment who are lovely and supportive and generous, right? And so there are few situations that feel so overwhelming that there is no human contact that can deal with them. You know, I have to go somewhere else. But that's not to ignore the fact that there are some people who don't have that opportunity, right? And so there are other mechanisms of just reducing feelings of whether it's desolation or desperation or pain or whatever it happens to be. And I think it's understandable because, again, we as human beings are responding, like most organisms do, to stuff that's this far away. And if I know that the solution to this problem is going to take a week or a month or a year, right, and I can feel better about it right here, I'm going to go here, right? And I think the idea about how does free will play into that, right? I think many people who feel less in control of their own lives do so because they see few options that are available to them. And those of us who do feel more in control, not only do we tend not to have as many dire consequences that we have to deal with, but when we do deal with consequences that are dire, we seem to have many resources, short of just numbing resources, that allow us to negotiate what we have to do.
And to think a little bit about the first part of the question, you know, when we were standing around in the back room before we came out, I was talking about the fact that there is a, you know, Pascal's wager, right, is this idea that God may or may not exist, but, you know, from his standpoint, you may as well act as if God exists, right? And I think that you can play us the same version of that game with consciousness or with free will, which is to say, free will may or may not exist, but there's, I think, a benefit to acting as though there is, but partly for our own sake and partly because of what it allows us to do in understanding and predicting other people's behavior. So I certainly think that that's a stance that's well worth adopting regardless of where you personally end up coming down on whether we are or are not conscious automata.
Another question?
So I'm curious what all of this implies about some of the more recent movements towards personhood for non-human animals is.
You know, that's an interesting question because it, as Art mentioned really early on in the talk, there is this sort of distinction, like evolution went on for a long time and, you know, each organism was a little incrementally different from the one before it. And then, poink, there were humans and we're like a whole other thing, you know. And, of course, what every next discovery tells us is, well, we're not that much of another thing. We're kind of like the same thing, just one more iteration of that. But I think the question you ask about what is what responsibility do we owe to organisms other than ourselves? I mean, and that's an interesting question because it raises evolutionary questions, right? I mean, obviously, humans evolved to be meat eaters, and there are certain dietary things that were part of our evolutionary history. And we have to think, well, if somebody makes a conscious decision to say, well, you know, I'm not going to eat living things, that's going to be a conscious decision that I'm going to make. That certainly is an understandable choice for someone to decide upon because they're saying, well, why was my dignity as a human being give me the right to sort of, you know, dominate other organisms, the fact that I would consume them, you know. But at the same time, I think one of the questions that's always asked, and it's interesting that we ask this question about medical research, we ask this question about zoos, we ask this question about all instances where animals are under the control of human beings. Is it right to do that? You know, and the interesting thing about that is that to me is a value question. It's not an empirical question. And I think one of the things that's sort of interesting about human debates, right, is that we often don't differentiate, is this an empirical question or is this a value question? Because those questions are answered in entirely different ways, right? And what's a little bit daunting about human beings is that we say, well, this is a value question, but if I find some empirical evidence that supports my position, I'll say, oh, wait, but look at that. Well, you've already decided this is an empirical question, right? So you have to decide this is a value question. What you raise is a really important issue that I think a lot of people are affected by deeply, but I obviously have no answer to that. But being a college professor, I just spoke for 3 minutes.
Three-ish. I just want to add one thing to this though, which I think, you know, to relate this to the question of free will. Is part of what makes it difficult for us to assess whether we have free will is that human beings are an extraordinarily complex system. But despite the fact that we are a complex system as an organism, we don't necessarily have the capacity to understand a lot of the things around us as intensely complex systems. And so human beings have spent a tremendous amount of time organizing environments in ways that feel particularly useful for us. And only to discover later that there were lots of unintended consequences of that organization of the environment, right? So we you know, one of the reasons that the Mississippi River floods as much as it does is because of all of the flood control work that we've done on the river, you know, which had devastating consequences for New Orleans, for example. And you know, in many cases, you know, I mean, the domestication of animals for food has also had consequences for the environment and for those animals and for the conditions that they live in. And so, you know, it's one of the fascinating things to me is that you know, part of the value question that gets that plays out here is in some sense to recognize our limitations, regardless of the free will that we have, the limitations that we have in really conceptualizing the complexity of the world as it is. And I think what that leads to is a little bit more potentially humility about the actions that we choose to take, recognizing that the thing that seems to us to be exactly the right answer to fix this enormous problem is often not the answer that fixes that. It changes that problem and turns it into another one that could be far worse. And so I think we should take a lesson from the internal complexity that we have to recognize that not only don't we understand ourselves all that well, we actually don't necessarily understand the world around us all that well. And sometimes it's better to just take a step back and watch what's going on rather than intervening on
it. And I have just one quick book title to plug in relationship to your question. The great primatologist Franz de Waal wrote a book that came out, I think, last fall called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? It's a great read, so I recommend that.
You know, we had a show not too long ago on Spinoza. You know, and Spinoza, writing in the 1600s, had lovely philosophy. I'm sure a lot of you are big fans of Spinoza. But he right?
No. Great guy.
No one.
Woo,
they're
great
like,
guy.
What the hell are you talking about?
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, a lot of his philosophy basically justified the mistreatment of animals. And he doesn't necessarily classify what an animal is. And at that time, you know, people from Africa, black people, were not considered human beings. And so a lot of his philosophy could be seen to justify slavery at that time. So I think these questions really need to be taken into consideration.
I have one statement about free will, though. Okay.
Shameless. Shameless.
So shameless. Bob and I wrote a book. And if anyone feels either compelled or decides freely that they want a copy, we have a few here tonight.
We didn't talk about fate.
And so I just wanted to let you know. It seemed the moment.
That's it.
That's beautiful.
Go, girl.
You're all fated to. Oh,
10 of you are fated.
Yeah. And as for this evening, thank you so much to Oliver Franklin. Thank you so much, Dr. Bob Duke and Art Markman. Thank you for coming out this evening and have a beautiful night.
You've been listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas, for KUT Radio. You'll find a complete archive of all of our Views and Brews in the iTunes store, or go to KUT.org for more information. Thanks for listening.